This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his best-selling book, Listening to Prozac, Dr. Peter Kramer examined the new anti-depression drugs and their impact on mood, self-image, and personality. His new book speaks to a question that is likely to plague you if you're having serious problems with your spouse or companion. Should you put more energy into trying to make the relationship work, or would you be better off just pulling out? Dr. Kramer's new book is called Should You Leave? In trying to help puzzle through that question, Kramer examines the larger issues of autonomy and identity within intimate relationships. Kramer is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University and has a private practice in Providence. He says it often seems that he could fill his entire practice with people who say they've fallen out of love. I asked him what he thinks that says about marriage today.
I think marriage is hard. I think marriage is difficult in the United States, and I think our requirements for our own happiness are very high. The notion that we should be self-fulfilled is very important to Americans, so that the sort of bumps in the road that have always, I assume, occurred in marriages and the sorts of disappointments that might have been resolved with turning outside the marriage are related to expectations within the marriage. People really want the marriage to do many things.
You could have probably gotten a book contract for just about any subject after the success of Listening to Prozac. You've chosen to focus this new book on marriages and the question of whether you should leave it or not if you don't think it's going well. And also in there is your dilemma about how much advice you should give to people on that question. Why did you make that the focus of your next book?
I think it was a perverse decision in some ways. I think I've been stung a little by some of the reviews of Listening to Prozac, which, you know, got 99% rave reviews, but there was that 1% that said this is not doctorly, that had some comments about the topic, and I think I had a perverse interest in writing something yet more popular and showing that I could do even that seriously and complexly. I think the other stimulus is that the sort of patient who interested me in Listening to Prozac, the person who was unassertive, loyal, in a way too good for the culture, continues to interest me. And that is the kind of person who gets into certain kinds of trouble in relationships. That is, who maybe bonds too strongly, doesn't share the American mania for autonomy. And the question about whether one can be an exception in this culture, whether one can stick too long with a marriage and yet make it work, I think interested me. I suppose there's some other reasons as well. I think in the back of my mind, I had some other books in mind relating to other patients. It's a kind of patient who comes in, a young college student, say, who seems not to understand how the culture works. You'll have a very attractive young man or woman who's never had a date, and I had in mind sort of a, I don't know what in the pre-AIDS era would have been maybe called, how to get laid. You know, that there was some sense that there are standard ways of negotiating this culture, and I think I was wondering as a therapist, whether we can use that knowledge, whether it's appropriate to say to someone, you know, rather than analyze the unconscious motivations behind failure, to say, you know, maybe you're just missing something fairly obvious about how people behave in this culture. You know, maybe you can't be quite as urgent in the relationship as you tend to be. And I think that question has a long history within psychoanalysis.
A lot of your book is about the kind of conflict between wanting autonomy and wanting to couple. And those things are sometimes really hard to do together. I'd like you to expand on that a little bit. You even give a test to tell if you fit into that category. That was a good one.
I think normal human beings have trouble holding on to themselves in groups, that we are created to be communal animals and to be, to some extent, influenced by leaders or companions. The test is really Murray Bowen's test, which is, if you're a young person and you go home to the family, how long can you remain yourself? Or if you're the parent, how long can you remain yourself in the face of this returning student? And the answer is probably gauged in minutes. You know, I think if you do well for 15 minutes, you probably are highly autonomous. And The question is that a test of maturity? I think that's a question that's been debated since World War II, is really what is maturity? And Murray Bowen, one of the great and founding family therapists, thought that the absolute measure of maturity was what he called differentiation of self, which was the ability to remain oneself in the face of group pressure, which, of course, is a very appealing idea post-war, you know, in face of totalitarianism, in the face of McCarthyism, looking at movies like High Noon or The Oxbow Incident. There's an American ideal, which is the autonomous self, the highly autonomous self. And, of course, it turns out to have roots that go back to Thoreau and Walden and maybe back to the Declaration of Independence. We're a very autonomous country, and I think not being overwhelmed by the other is a measure of how mature we are, how well we're going to function in complex situations. On the other hand, I think it is very hard to build relationships purely on this ideal of autonomy.
On the other hand, have you come to think that it's a sign of maturity if you know how to compromise and to bend in a relationship, not to sacrifice your identity, but
I think there are elements of maturity that this definition centered on autonomy misses, and that maybe even losing oneself is a quality of maturity, the ability to enter and leave, to oscillate. I think that passion is a human good, and to say that maturity is, in a sense, the opposite of the ability to be passionate seems to me wrong, and that those patients or people who come in and say, look, I don't want only to be more autonomous. I want to get lost in the relationship. I want to trust another person more than it's reasonable to trust. Can I get away with it? I think, well, that might be dangerous to advise, but it's hard not to be sympathetic to that if one understands love to be a reasonable human wish.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kramer, and he's the author of Listening to Prozac. Now he has a new book called Should You Leave? A Psychiatrist Explores Intimacy and Autonomy and the Nature of Advice. I'm wondering if you come across a lot of couples where one person is very bendable and isn't very autonomous the way that would be defined, and the other person is, so that one person remains fixed and the other person kind of bends to enter the sphere of the spouse and then comes to resent it.
Well, I think that is the typical marital problem of the era, isn't it? That women are taught to enhance mutuality, to make relationships work, to find pride in the husband's achievements, and the men are taught to go out and be world beaters. And when you change that relationship a little, when you also emphasize some greater level of autonomy for women, you create trouble, and I would say useful trouble, because one of the problems with advice is, I think if one advises autonomy, the person who is already strong, autonomous, maybe somewhat unfeeling and uncaring, hears that message very well. And if you emphasize connection, the person who already is giving everything hears that message very well. And I think that's an inherent danger in advice at the moment. You really want the messages to go against temperament. You want to say to the person who's highly autonomous, it's all right to give a little. It's all right to accept some other person's goals. It's all right to make sacrifices for the sake of the relationship, which has an inherent value. There's something about relationship that can make it an entity with some inherent value of its own. And you want to say to the person who's giving too much, look, the way to make this relationship work, the way to demand mutuality, is to be yourself very vigorously. You know, I think this book cuts a little against the American grain in saying there are limits to autonomy. But, of course, there are people still, many people, and maybe it's mainly women, to whom one wants to say, yes, you need to be more autonomous, not just for your own sake, but for the sake of the relationship as well.
I think there's a related question to this that you raise in the book, and that is, well, you know, I think, like, if you're in a relationship, the person you're in a relationship with is almost like a mirror, and their sense of who you are is constantly reflected back at you. And if their sense of who you are emphasizes your own insecurities or your own flaws, then you're constantly looking into a mirror that emphasizes the negative aspects of you. And even somebody who loves you can be capable of emphasizing those parts.
Yes, I think we become possessed. One of my teachers, Leston Havens, talks about possession as a danger in relationships. And that the stronger person, the conventionally stronger person in the relationship, almost takes the strength of the weaker person, reflects back her, let's say, inadequacies, and walks around the world looking for all that anyone else can see, extremely competent, married to an incompetent spouse. And I think that is one of the dangers of relationships, that people get swallowed slowly.
My guest is Dr. Peter Kramer. His new book is called Should You Leave? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Peter Kramer, author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac and the new book Should You Leave? About intimacy and autonomy in relationships. I'm wondering if in relationships that you have discussed with patients, if you've seen people be able to change, if you've seen somebody who, for instance, is the bending kind of person, the more pliant person who reshapes their personality to suit the relationship and is in a relationship with somebody who's more fixed and autonomous, if the more pliant person can ever change and become more autonomous within that relationship. In other words, do you think that relationships and individuals can change, or whether more often than not the person has to walk out?
Yes, I think people change. I certainly have seen people change. And I think an interesting question is, what is change? What counts as change? I think one thing that certainly does not count as change is doing something tentatively or occasionally, so that the flexible person or maybe even abused person who occasionally asserts himself gets slapped down. But if one can be assertive, even in small ways, very persistently, I think that gets noticed, taken into account. It alters the whole form of the relationship. Almost always people come in and say, I have to leave the relationship because I've tried and I've already tried and the relationship with the other person won't budge. And what I find lacking, you know, what I doubt, the fictive attitude I cast on that claim is that I think people very often don't understand, from my point of view anyway, how persistent change has to be. It may be that change doesn't have to be very great, but it has to be carried out in a persistent way. And I think part of what goes on in therapy is not only self-understanding, but it's something like coaching. It's helping the person do it again and again and see where it has to be done in small ways.
I guess the same is true of the other side, too. If you feel like your partner needs to change, that they're hurting you in a certain way or doing something damaging within the relationship, that if they just kind of change a couple of times and say, there, I've changed, that, that
yes,
they're just fooling
skeptical.
Themselves. Yeah,
mm-hmm. We've been hurt. I mean, there's some wonderful writing by Vicky Hearn about crazy horses, where she talks about what you need to do to train horses. And, you know, there are horses, she claims, who are hard to manage because people have been too nice to them in inconsistent ways, and that if the trainer tries to be nice again, the trainer's going to get kicked or thrown. And what the trainer has to be is firm and consistent. And I think, you know, that there's some analogy. I don't want to put horse training too much on the level of changing your spouse, but I think there's something similar that goes on in relationships, which is you need to give signals firmly and consistently and to have enough faith in yourself to do that. I think that very often people come in and say, I want my spouse to change or my partner to change. And the therapist thinks, well, maybe if you changed consistently, that would be adequate. Maybe the partner would change, or maybe your needs would change. I think that the philosopher Stanley Cavell is someone I turn to a lot in the book, and he really emphasizes how often what we need is not the fulfillment of needs, but a change in our needs, and then the external world becomes adequate.
You suggest that if you're in a relationship that's having trouble, instead of trying to change the other person, which is usually somewhere between difficult and impossible, change yourself. Change the way you're interpreting the problems within the relationship. Give me an example of what you mean there.
Well, I want to say that I hope I don't say anything too strongly.
I know you have this whole fear. I mean, the distaste for giving advice and for writing a self-help book. And I know that's true. And I'm trying to talk about this without it sounding too pat, because you don't mean it to be pat, and it isn't pat.
It goes beyond a distaste to, I think, a view of how the world is, which is that the world is very complicated. People are very
crazy.
They're particular in their individuality. their needs are not standard.
Uh-huh.
And that what is good advice one day is probably bad advice the next.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, I think going against the grain is very important. I write in the book about a young man who seems a little obsessional and prissy, I would say, and who feels his girlfriend is a little beneath him because she isn't quite as intellectual as he is. But when you look a little more closely at their interactions, she's always undermining him by saying something that shows she's really quite smart, that she has his number. And the advice I seem to want to give him in that story, and it's not clear whether I give it or not, is he has a particular, sort of superior wish for pristine apartments, for not wanting too much overstuffed furniture in a room. And the advice I give him is almost to just let her decorate the living room, you know, that there's some sense that going against one's own temperament is difficult. It allows some growth, which if you actually do end the relationship later, is something you can take with you. That the one argument for changing the self is, well, if the relationship doesn't work, having grown in some aspect is something that goes beyond the particular relationship. But in addition, you know, it may be that one comes to appreciate the less obsessional qualities, the quietness, the messiness of the partner, and to understand that this partner, you know, the wife or girlfriend in this case, really has some aspect of reality, you know, is in touch with some aspect of reality that he isn't. And I think that is what change often is. It's some persistent attempt to go against the grain of temperament or personality and be a bigger person.
When someone comes to you and they are perplexed by this question, should I stay in this relationship that's having trouble or should I leave? What's your approach to helping them decide? You're not going to tell them what to do. Will you offer any advice? And if not, what's your kind of larger approach to helping them figure out what the best answer might be for them?
Well, I think broadly the application is this. I think broadly the approach is this application of multiple perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give advice by and large. On the other hand, I think my view of psychotherapy is that it is trying to do something, almost prissy in itself if it's trying to stay away entirely from social norms. I think if someone is very giving and self-sacrificing and the other partner is clearly taking all the time, that is a certain point, and maybe that point is early, the therapist or advisor has to say, look, this guy's a bit of a jerk, or, you know, tell me why the following is not the case, and present society's external view of what is equitable in a relationship. And then the patient can come back and say, yes, but you don't see all the other things that he does for me. You don't see what my own shortcomings are. That I think, begins a discussion, although very often that objection has to be followed by saying, well, I think I do see those things, and I still think the relationship's inequitable. I really feel patients are done a disservice by too much neutrality, that at a certain point they have to be confronted with alternative stories about how this relationship adds up.
So as a psychiatrist, you don't want to give advice, you should do this, you should do that. On the other hand, you do say that you lean in the direction of reconciliation in a relationship. Why?
Well, I think therapists in general lean toward reconciliation. People who've looked at this and interviewed therapists, couple therapists, find that. I think there are a number of reasons. One is we value complexity, that a complex relationship is a place where a person can grow. And even if the person intends or ought finally to leave, that growing in an area where you're paralyzed, where the other person seems very powerful, where there's a lot of inertia, that is exactly the greenhouse for growth. That instead of leaving and doing the same thing again, you must change, because what is the point of making the same mistake again and again? The whole point of change has to be some kind of change in the self that you can take with you. The other thing I think is just observational, that it looks like second and third marriages are not especially better than first marriages. And if they are, they're better because the spouses in the next marriage are willing to make compromises. They're willing to be more empathic. They're willing to do without or experience some loss of self. And if those same things were done in the first relationship, it might have worked. I think, and of course, the divorce rates for second and third marriages are very high. The length of average of second and third marriages is very short. So there's a lot to be said for working with first marriages. And I want to say here, I'm not talking about openly abusive marriages. I'm not talking about what are obviously marriages of convenience, where a young person leaves an abusive family by marriage and enters a relationship without much thought and then uses that relationship as a stepping stone to enter the world. I'm talking about serious relationships where people are obviously fairly well matched, and the problem is maybe persistent but small, subtle, workable.
Peter Kramer's new book is called Should You Leave? We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Dr. Peter Kramer. His new book, Should You Leave?, examines the question most people have who are in a troubled relationship. Is it better to put more energy into making the relationship work or to just end it? Kramer is also the author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac about the new antidepressant drugs. Part of your new book, Should You Leave?, about relationships relates a lot to your earlier book, Listening to Prozac. And there's a really interesting chapter about mood swings, depression, and relationships. And you say that sometimes when a marriage is having trouble, what you have to do is treat one person's depression, and that the depression might really be the source of the trouble.
If you look at the objective data, surveys of people in troubled relationships show that half of the women in troubled relationships meet standard, strict criteria for depressive disorder, and that depression is 25 times as prevalent in both men and women in troubled relationships. And this doesn't count people who enter the relationship when depressed and are no longer depressed, and it doesn't count mania, and it doesn't count more subtle forms of depression, so that just on a statistical basis, it would seem that many, many troubled relationships have one or the other partner with a mood disorder or some very substantial change in mood. And in particular...
Go ahead.
Well, I would say also that this issue just impassions me, that for some reason that I can't quite explain, I'm very frustrated by being a Cassandra who sees one partner to be depressed and yet hears from the people in the marriage that the marriage just isn't working for some entirely other reason. So that people will come in and say, our values are different, we're not communicating, we don't enjoy time together. And I'll say, let's discuss this again after we treat your or your spouse's depression, because I know that those issues, many times I've seen those issues just fade away when the depression is treated. And I'm not especially advocating medicine as the treatment for depression. It could be medication. It could be a psychotherapy that focuses on depression rather than marital discord. It could be both together. But that depression is a terrible limitation of perspective, and that when the depression is treated, people just see the relationship differently.
Speaking of depression, it's been about, 4 years since the publication of Listening to Prozac. So you've had a few more years of observing Prozac, observing the people who take it. It's only been on the market since 1987, so You've had just about twice as long to see it now as you did when you wrote the book. Has anything fundamentally changed in your view of Prozac's usefulness in treating people with depression over the short or long term?
Yes, I think the sexual side effects are certainly more prominent. It's clearer that people have delayed ejaculation or orgasm or decreased sexual interest on these medicines. I think the book was early in pointing that out, but I think it's much clearer than it was when I wrote the book. I think there, something else I mentioned in the book has become clearer also, which is some people sort of burn out on the medicines, that the medicines start being less effective over time. And I think there are biological reasons for that, which people know more about, and there are treatments for people for who seem to develop tolerance to these medicines. I think that's a whole important area. And I think my worries about the medicines have in some ways increased. I am worried that these medicines are being used very long term. Within the field, the length of time for which antidepressants are prescribed has increased very rapidly. People used to be treated for 6 months at a time, then for a year, and now some people are kept on indefinitely. And we really don't know whether these medicines, even though they're good in the short term, in some ways increase the liability to mood disorder in people. We just don't know what it means to push these biological systems very hard in a given direction. So I would say, although nothing very bad has been discovered about these medicines on a statistical basis or in research over a few years, I am quite worried about the extent to which they're used and the length of time for which they're prescribed. You know, it should be said in parallel that the reason that they're prescribed for long periods of time is that there also are more worries about depression and its effects. It really looks as if depression damages the brain in some ways and that you don't want people to be depressed.
So do you find yourself prescribing Prozac any more or less than before, or describing it for different intervals of time than you did a few years ago?
I still tend to prescribe it fairly late in the course of treatment. I think I'm slower than most doctors. I like to do psychotherapy for a while if I can. I think I'm stuck in the same bind all doctors are, which is that if a person has had multiple episodes of depression or very dangerous depressions, I find it hard to take people off the antidepressants. I do. I try to take them off slowly. That's something else that has been written about a lot over the last few years, which is that there are some withdrawal syndromes from these medicines. I try to take them off slowly to try to fool the brain and not have it witness some abrupt changes in levels of the neurotransmitters. But I do like to take people off and see how they do on intervals without medication.
So it sounds like as a doctor, you're really working with a fairly high level of uncertainty with the new antidepressants, because there isn't information about the real long term.
Yes, and I think that is always the case. I think you can't keep a medicine off the market 20 years to see whether it has long-term effects experimentally. And anyway, in 20 years, there'll be some other medicine that on theoretical grounds ought to be much more effective. So you're always working with new medicines whose long-term effects have to be gauged in part from animal studies, in part from theoretical considerations. I do think something is missing in the American system, which is the requirement for long-term follow-up on the part of the drug companies or maybe the federal government as their proxy. The requirements to market a drug often are quite reasonable as regards medicines like antibiotics that are used for a few weeks or asthma drugs that are used intermittently. But as regards a medicine you might take every day for many years, there are not adequate requirements for what's called post-marketing research, that really the drug companies who are making enormous profits from these medicines ought to be spending large amounts of money seeing what their long-term effects are and what their effects are on special audiences like the elderly and children for whom the drugs are not initially tested before they're marketed.
I realize this is probably none of my business, but have you ever tried Prozac either for clinical reasons or just out of curiosity to see what impact it would have on you so you'd understand more about the drug?
No, I haven't. And I think my interest in some ways isn't Prozac so much as what these different elements in psychiatry, individual therapy, couple therapy, and medication tell us about the modern self and what our eagerness for certain psychiatric solutions tells us about the culture. I really think of myself much more as a writer and a cultural critic than I do as a specialist in medication.
Dr. Peter Kramer is the author of the bestseller Listening to Prozac. His new book about intimacy and autonomy in relationships is called Should You Leave?